Good morning. Come to our second study in the book of Romans. And my goal today is to cover verses 8 through 17, just maybe one or two more verses than we did last week. My difficulty, if you want to call it that, is that the last two verses, 16 and 17, are packed with meaning and a certain amount of controversy. So I think I'm going to be able to get through this, but I'll probably go a little bit lighter on the first part than I had originally wanted to. Anyway, Romans 1, I'll read verses 8 through 17. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit and the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers, making request if by some means now at last I may find a way in the will of God to come to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift, so that you may be established. That is, that I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith, both of you and me. Now I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I often planned to come to you, but was hindered until now, that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among the other Gentiles. I am a debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to wise and to unwise. So, as much as is in me, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome also. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Now, last week we introduced the book of Romans and saw that in the first seven verses, Paul is making his case, at least this is, I think, a helpful perspective, is making his case to the Romans that they should pay attention to his ministry, and especially the letter that he is writing to them. He's, as it were, presenting his credentials as a faithful apostle, separated to the gospel of God. And in that course of that, he also sets forth the significant nature of the gospel, that it concerns his Son, Jesus Christ. I want to make one comment in connection with last week's study when I was talking about some maybe subtle differences in terms of the interpretation of verses 3 and 4. I said something about this view, especially the emphasis on the mediatorial reign of Christ as the God-man, that hadn't been prominent in the interpretation. I went back, that was sort of an offhand comment, I went back and looked and found that John Murray in his commentary does have one sentence in reference to the mediatorial kingship of Christ with this verse, and Haldane, whom I actually hadn't read that part of Haldane's commentary before, has more. It does seem a little strange that no one connects the seed of David reference, the first phase as we described it, with the second phase, with his ruling and power. Surely thinking of David would make us think of the mediatorial kingship of Christ. In any case, that's an interesting point, maybe for further reflection. So after that greeting, then, he finally gets to the specific greeting, you might say, in verse 7. He turns in verse 8 and the following verses to write to the Romans a kind of a commendation and encouragement and a prayer for them. Now, this is a pattern that you can see in other epistles of Paul. He'll often give his greetings, usually shorter than what we just covered last week. He'll give his greetings, but then he will give a prayer to God for them, a thanksgiving to God for them, and some kind of a commendation for their faith. The only place where the commendation doesn't occur, I believe, is in Galatians, where he has other things to say to them. But here he starts the same way. And as I mentioned, I'm going to try to go a little bit more quickly over this part just because verses 16 and 17 are so packed, but you should notice at least a few aspects of this. Here he's thanking God thanking God for them that their faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. So notice specifically that he rejoices in them, in God blessing them with faith, and that implies that faith is a gift of God. And notes that faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. Now, he makes comments like this in Colossians 1 and probably elsewhere. They seem to be maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but I think when he speaks of the whole world, he's recognizing that the gospel has spread widely already through much of the known world. In the passage we looked at last week in Romans 15, he talks about that spread of the gospel through him that God has accomplished. But here it's remarkable, I think, especially that the gospel should have taken root in Rome. It would be like us remarking that it's amazing that there should be a Bible-believing church on Capitol Hill or something like that, which there's a fairly prominent Baptist church in that place. It's probably like that. Probably the Christians around the world were amazed to think that God's power was shown in establishing a church even in Rome. You have to realize that the seat of power and the corresponding idolatry and corruption that would come with the seat of power. And so their faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. It's a remarkable thing. And that gives us a sense of the fellowship that the church has had with each other. We, unfortunately, in America, tend to think of our churches as isolated. I hope as Presbyterians we don't do so much. But here there's an implied fellowship, an appreciation that they had a common faith and could remark in the work of God. Now what follows in verses 9 through 15 is a fairly remarkable statement by the Apostle Paul, and it's one that it's easy to pass over, and that's why it's a little painful for me to have to trim what I was, some of the points I was going to say about it. You have to cut out some things always, but just to show you the seriousness of this and how Paul wants them to recognize the seriousness of it, he starts with an oath. I don't know if you looked at it that way, but when he says, God is my witness, he's really, in effect, taking an oath. And Paul wouldn't take the name of God in vain. He wouldn't just use that phrase unless he had something very serious to communicate with them, to them. And what is it he wants to communicate to them? It is that he wants to visit them. Okay? Now, think about that. Why would he take an oath to swear that he wanted to visit them? Well, we'll see some of that as we go along, but in essence, this is connected with the opening part of the letter where he's presenting his credentials. He's still trying to show them that though he had never been there and he was not the one who had planted the church, he still loves them and cares about them and desires to have fellowship with them. And he expresses that in various ways. First, in referring to that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers. That importunate, persevering prayer. And the point of the prayer, the request is given in verse 10, what I said. Now at last I may find a way in the will of God to come to you. Now, he wants to come to them for really two specific reasons. And the first one in verse 11 that he gives is that he would impart to them some spiritual gift that they may be established. And you can see a similar statement at the end of verse 13 that he might have some fruit among them also, just as among the other Gentiles. By the way, that reinforces the point. I may not have made the evidence very clear last week, but when he refers to them just as among the other Gentiles, that reinforces the point that his audience was largely Gentile, that the Roman believers were largely not Jewish but Gentile. So that's something we would expect him to say. Paul wants to go to bless them with his ministry. Imparting of a spiritual gift may or may not be the kind of ecstatic gifts that you see elsewhere. There were lots of things that could come through the blessing of the apostolic ministry. But he wants them to be established in the faith. They're already believers. He's already acknowledged their faith in verse 8. But Paul recognizes that every believer can be further established or confirmed or encouraged in the faith. We should always be seeking to grow. We shouldn't view the Christian life as something that's static. And that's what Paul longed to do. He longed to be among them, and to encourage them in that way. I'll just point you to a cross-reference in chapter 15 of the book, verses 14 through 33, a longer section, where he develops this point further, that he wants to visit them, he wants to be a blessing to them, and there's a mutual aspect of that that I'm about to come to. So here Paul is stressing that God having separated him to the ministry, has also called him to preach the gospel, and he wishes to see fruit among them also. What's more remarkable is the second reason why he wants to be there. In verse 12, it almost sounds like he's correcting himself. So he says, I want to come, in verse 11, to impart some spiritual gift so that you may be established. And then verse 12, that is, that I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith, both of you and me. It is kind of a remarkable thing, isn't it, that this mighty apostle, this one who had God, whom God had blessed to plant churches, as he says, you know, throughout much of the known world in Romans 15, that he should almost correct himself. He should hesitate lest he presume on them. Right? It wasn't as if he had established a church in Rome. He had apostolic authority, and yet Paul was actually, we don't think of it this way. He was actually very sensitive about the use of his authority. He showed a lot of concern for those he wrote to. Here he says something very remarkable. It's not just that I want to go there to encourage you, he says, but I want to go there so you can encourage me. That is, that I may, he says in verse 12, may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith, both of you and me. He recognizes that they have faith. He's already said that. And he says, we can encourage each other because we have a common faith. And this is a remarkable point. I thought I would read, of all people, Calvin, who expands on this point. Surely Calvin wouldn't have thought that any minister could be encouraged by anyone else. Well, this is what he says. Note how modestly he expresses what he feels by not refusing to seek strengthening from inexperienced beginners. He means what he says, too. For there is none so void of gifts in the Church of Christ who cannot in some measure contribute to our spiritual progress. Ill will and pride, however, prevent our deriving such benefit from one another. Such is our superiority, and such the intoxicating effect of our stupid boasting, that every one of us despises and disregards others, and considers that he possesses a sufficient abundance for himself. Okay. So I'd like for us to think of that as we talk with believers, if we have lunch together, as we have occasion, that is an opportunity for this sort of mutual encouragement that Paul is referred to here. So Paul wants them to know that he loves them, that he wants to visit them. And in explanation of this, has been hindered to come to them. And again, I'd encourage you this afternoon or when you have time to look at Romans 15, where he brings up the same point. I was hindered until now. Our pastor in preaching in 1 Thessalonians mentioned Paul also, well, we saw Paul also hindered. There it seemed to be a satanic hindering. Here, it's not clear exactly why he was hindered, maybe just a providential reference to hindering. But it's remarkable that Paul wants to communicate to them his love and the fact that he's been praying for this, that he's been hindered in doing it, but he still wants to be there. He wants to convince them of that fact. Now, of course, Paul does get there, right? He doesn't get there maybe in the circumstances he would have preferred. Right? Probably when he was praying that I would come to Rome, he didn't think with chains, right, that I'm going to be tied up. I'm going to have an obligation to appear before Caesar, although that worked for the glory of God also. But it is a remarkable thing, and I'd especially encourage you, if you have or you want to borrow, John Murray's commentary on Romans. He makes some very helpful points here about how we should pray about matters for which we don't have a specific revelation in the will of God. That is, you know, we don't have a commandment from God to do something, but that is consistent with the will of God. How we should persevere in prayer, even if we don't have an immediate answer to prayer. This ties in with the study that Dan Yost led on just do something, right? Not to wait around, to be uncertain, waiting for some specific guidance from God. But here the Apostle Paul persevered in his prayers, even though they weren't being answered, and even though he didn't really have a specific promise from God that he would go to Rome at this point. Later on he did. But he here shows that he is serious about seeking God's will and about submitting to God's will, yet at the same time persevering without ceasing, making mention of you always and making that request. So it's something that it will instruct us, I think, in our own praying and perseverance in that. He concludes really the section on his desire to go to Rome by a fairly general statement in verse 14, I am a debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to wise and to unwise. So the Greeks and barbarians are supposed to represent everyone. Everyone is in one category or the other. And the wise and unwise similarly. Whether those line up exactly, Greeks and wise and barbarians and unwise, isn't, I think, so important. The Greeks then are those who represent the cultured, the sophisticated. The word barbarian in the original Greek is, here's the term they use in English, onomatopoeia. Okay, so that is, it's a word that imitates a sound. So like meow, right, that's a word that's supposed to imitate a cat. I've never actually heard a cat say that. But so the word barbarian in the original Greek imitates the way the foreign languages sounded to the cultured Greeks. These people sound like they're babbling, bar, 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 you know, that sort of thing. So it was an insult, okay, from a Greek to be called a barbarian. That's still sort of an insult. But the point that Paul is making is that it doesn't matter whether you consider yourself sophisticated and cultured or whether you're on the outside, you know, some backwoods hick sort of person as far as the Greeks were concerned, whether you're wise or whether you're unwise, Paul had an obligation to all of those people to preach the gospel. Okay? And we shouldn't be, in a similar way, we shouldn't be discriminating in the sense that we shouldn't say, well, you know, I think these people are probably, they don't particularly need the gospel. They already have their own religion or they already have their own culture or whatever. Paul particularly found it difficult to preach to those who were wise in their own eyes. Just read 1 Corinthians, especially chapter 1. The power of God in the gospel is foolishness to those who are wise in this world. But Paul here expresses a general statement that he has a debt to all men, and then applies it in verse 15, so he wants to come and preach the gospel to them who are in Rome. Now, whether the recipients of his letter would have thought of themselves as Greeks, that is, cultured, or as barbarians, maybe there were some of both. He certainly ministered among all sorts of people elsewhere. But there's a particularly interesting point, which is when Paul says, preach the gospel to you who are in Rome, it seems fairly clear that he doesn't mean that he's going to evangelize the city of Rome. He means he's going to preach the gospel to them, to those who are receiving the letter, which is an important point because, you know, we may think that we don't need to hear the gospel anymore, but we always need to hear the gospel. The gospel has to be preached to us, in essence, week by week. And Paul's aim in imparting a spiritual gift and establishing them and so on and so on, again, Romans 15 expands on that, can be summarized in saying, I'm going to preach the gospel to you. I'm going to, just as he does basically in the rest of the letter, he's going to, this is a nice gnat flying around here, I'm going to preach the gospel. That's his desire. Okay. Actually, I probably cut out more than I intended. Any comments or questions there on that first part? I left out a lot of good stuff. Okay. So then the last, okay, this does look kind of strange. So 20 minutes on those verses and the last 30 minutes or so, in case you're keeping track, on verses 16 and 17. Verses 16 and 17, as I said, are very densely packed in terms of the theology that Paul is going to be presenting in the rest of the book and correspondingly a certain amount of controversy, especially one phrase that we'll look at. So Paul here, in essence, is giving the theme for the rest of the book of Romans. And it ties in, of course, with what he was just saying about preaching the gospel. And it's actually, there's a sort of a chain of reasoning here. I am not ashamed of the gospel for, OK, Okay, so here's the reason why he's not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. Why? Well, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. So there's a chain of reasoning here. He's explaining each of the phrases that he gives here. And of course it begins with a four because he's explaining why he's ready to preach the gospel in Rome. Now, it may seem a little negative to start with, I am not ashamed of the gospel. But Paul, you might say, especially in Rome, would have had plenty of reasons to be aware of, there were plenty of reasons to know that he would be scorned when he preached the gospel more broadly in Rome. Rome was, again, a center of power and of a certain amount of sophistication, although the Greeks would not have agreed with that. But even in other places where Paul had been, he had seen the scorn of people with response to the gospel. The wise Greeks thought it was foolishness. A resurrection, why would you want a bodily resurrection? That's a body is a prison. We don't want to be raised from the dead. So Paul had seen the scorn of people again and again, and he insists that he is not ashamed of the gospel. He is ready to preach the gospel in Rome because it's nothing to be ashamed of. This is may echo Christ's own words that anyone who is ashamed of me in that day, Christ himself will be ashamed of, and that person will be rejected. Now we should of course recognize that the gospel in our own day is still a matter of scorn, and we still have to realize that we need not to be ashamed of the gospel. And I hope that the last part, verses 16 and 17, will give us plenty of reason. Though the world thinks it's a worthless exercise, the gospel is only foolishness, yet we should keep in mind that it is the power of God to salvation. And so you can see how closely tied all of these are. He is not ashamed of the gospel. He's ready to go to Rome, even that place where he could expect great hostility and opposition because of the importance of the gospel. Just as he talked about in verses 3 and 4, the importance of the gospel as it concerns the Son of God. So here again is the importance of the gospel as it concerns the salvation of God's people. Now, part of the reason these verses are so densely packed is that he uses words that are very significant in meaning. Okay, it's easy for us to read over them because we know the words. So we have the Christian lingo. Okay, but when he says it's the power of God to salvation, well, it first implies that our salvation requires power. It's not as if we're a little bit ill. You know, if we just had a little bit of more social programs, a little bit more money, a little better education, everything would be fine. No, apparently God has to exercise power to save us. Okay? And the salvation that he's talking about isn't even that kind of salvation I was describing. Salvation in the scriptures, and again, this is going to be all spelled out. Paul is just saying here up front what he's going to be talking about the rest of the book, that salvation has to do with our native condition, that we are, in fact, in sin, enslaved to sin, that we are guilty before God. We have no righteousness of our own, that we are alienated from God and dead. Okay? And on the other hand, salvation provides life and fellowship with God, the righteousness that we need to stand before him, the forgiveness of sins, and everything that is the restoration to full fellowship with God. So when he refers to the power of God to salvation, he's talking about something very rich. The specific aspect of justification is what's going to occupy the first part of the book. But he goes on even beyond that to the richness of God's salvation and the outworking of that in the following verses. And in connection with that, he emphasizes a point that that he emphasizes again and again in connection with our salvation, that it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. Okay, so this is the centrality of faith as receiving the salvation. And since I'll probably focus more on the first part of verse 17, let me at this point pick up the last part of verse 17 where this same thing is brought up again. In that the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, that is written, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. So Paul, later on, will make absolute the contrast between receiving this salvation by faith and receiving it by works, or justification by faith alone versus justification by works. And here he already sounds the trumpet that the justification, the salvation he's talking about, is something that is a gift of God that we receive by faith. It's not something that we, in a sense, contribute to. We receive it with the empty hands of faith, as it's often said. So that's an extremely critical point here up front. That is a rejection of the Jewish distortion of the Old Testament, which he had to battle against again and again. I'll come back to that point, but Paul is here contending with a misunderstanding of the Old Testament, and here emphasizes faith. That's why, by the way, he quotes from the Old Testament, "The just shall live by faith," Habakkuk 2:4. I put up a couple of other references where to that verse in the New Testament. But here Paul is emphasizing the point he had made already back in verse 2, right? The gospel he preached wasn't something new. It's something that was promised before through his prophets and the Holy Scriptures. And here he emphasizes that the righteousness of God being revealed from faith to faith is something that's confirmed even in the book of Habakkuk and in the witness there. Okay, this is one of the things I had to cut out. I won't go through how that ties in with what Habakkuk says. Habakkuk is dealing with a crisis of the looming destruction of the Assyrians, and how could God do that. But I'll just say, in essence, Paul is adapting that encouragement to Habakkuk to say that the only way that we are accepted before God and the only way for us to live is by faith. And the from faith to faith, okay, so there are lots of interpretations. There's a long list of possible interpretations. But it seems to me to make sense in the context, since he had just emphasized in verse 16 that it's the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek, that it has these two components, that it is a justification, it is received by faith, but it is also for everyone who has faith. So there are those two aspects of it, and we may tend to emphasize the one, the justification by faith alone, but Paul especially, now going back at the end of verse 16, emphasizes the second part, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. That is a very important point. It is like his point of saying he's going to preach to Greeks and barbarians. It doesn't matter who you are, right? It doesn't matter what you've done, what your backstory, where did that phrase come from? What your backstory is, you know, what your history is, what baggage you have. It doesn't matter in a sense. Everyone who trusts in Christ is saved. Everyone who believes in Him alone, you could be the worst filthy sinner that Paul might have seen in the streets of Corinth, or the sophisticated philosopher, they were pretty filthy too, in Athens. To everyone who believes, the gospel is the power of God for salvation. And that's an encouragement to us as we minister the gospel, to know that no one can say, well, it's not for me. It would never help me. No, it's the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. But that's not exactly the nuance that Paul brings. At the end of verse 16, he does say, but it's for the Jew first. Okay? And this is a point which I think we should reflect on at least just a minute. That was the priority of Paul himself in his ministry. Even though he was the apostle to the Gentiles, where did he go when he went to a new city? He went to the synagogue, right? To the Jew first. And it was a temporal priority, you might say, even in Jesus' ministry. Jesus actually often refused to go to minister to the Gentiles because he was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So there's certainly a temporal priority there. In time, the gospel was in Jerusalem, and then when Judea and Samaria and the uttermost parts of the world. But I don't think it's limited to that. It's drawing on the fact that the gospel you might say, came to the Jew first in the Old Testament, if I could speak that way. That is, the promises, the ones that Paul is going to be drawing on later to Abraham and elsewhere, those promises were to the Jews. And the fact that those promises were to the Jews gives an emphasis to the priority of Jewish ministry. In fact, I will argue when we get to Romans 9, not saying when we will get there, but in Romans 9 through 11, I will argue that in fact there is a special way in which the promises are relevant to the Jews. Not that they'll inherit the promised land physically, or that they'll get missiles from the U.S. or something like that, but there is a special promise for God to restore them to the Messiah whom they have rejected. I believe that's the case, and I think that also lends seriousness to the gravity of this. It's to the Jew first. And that's why it's so sad that both Jews and Gentiles so often don't believe this. Right? The Jews don't believe that the gospel is for them first. The Jews in our day believe the gospel is for Christians, right? Or at least for non-Jewish people. But it's also sad, and Stephen Atkinson, I think, made this point of priority well when he was visiting recently, that it's also sad that too many Gentile Christians don't believe that the gospel ministry among the Jews and evangelization of the Jews is a priority. It hasn't always been that way. The RP Church had missions to Jews in Philadelphia, I believe, within the last 100 years or so, and many other groups have sought to evangelize the Jews. But there's this aspect of the book of Romans that I brought up last week. I wouldn't say it's the main theme. It's connected with a certain serious error that I'll try to talk about later on. But it is an important theme. And it is important for us to realize that God worked in history. And his working in history certainly incorporates the Gentiles into the church. But there is still a certain priority there. Okay. So, here we go. Now we're at verse 17. Okay, we'll spend the rest of the time at least in verse 17. For in it, the gospel, in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. So I'm going to talk about that, the righteousness of God being revealed. Let me start with the last word, revealed. That may make you think of, you know, some weird Gnostic mystery religion, like here's a special secret. But the word doesn't really seem to communicate the idea of some hidden knowledge which is made known by, you know, some special words, but it's a sort of a dynamic thing. It's a revealed in the sense of openly shown. And if you like, you can see the parallel in verse 18. In verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed, right? And it's not revealed because the wicked people who are described in the following verses read about it in the Bible. It's the wrath of God is, you might say, openly shown. And part of his wrath is shown in a very profound way, and that is even confirming sinners in their wickedness, giving them over to their wickedness. So in a parallel but blessedly reverse way, here the gospel, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. It's something that's worked out in a way that's demonstrated, that's possible to see. It's not some mystery that's communicated, but something, you might say, that's openly shown. And what is it that's openly shown? Well, it's the righteousness of God. Okay. So now I'm going to have to spend some time talking about this phrase. We're going to have to put our thinking caps on a little bit, the way we did last week. Only this has to do with... Last week I said, you know, those views that I talked about, they were both perfectly orthodox. One of the views that I'm going to describe is sadly often taken in a seriously defective way. But before I talk about that, let me just say what Paul does, and at first a little bit, doesn't mean by the righteousness of God. Now, in English, when we think about the righteousness of God, we tend to think of an attribute of God, that God is righteous. Okay, and the Greek doesn't actually function that way, and part of the limitation is that when we think of the word justify, we don't necessarily relate it to the word righteous. But in the Greek, they have the same root word. To justify is to declare that someone is in a state of righteousness, has a status before God. And so when you see righteousness of God, you shouldn't necessarily think of the justice of God or the attribute of God in himself. After all, it wouldn't be much of a gospel, would it, for the justice of God to be revealed. He would be essentially saying the same thing he says in verse 18, that the wrath of God is revealed. Because if you're a sinner and the righteousness of God is revealed to you, you're toast, I guess is the phrase, right? So the wrath of God will come upon you. So that when you see the righteousness of God, although that's an important aspect of it, and that's key, you shouldn't simply think of it in terms of God being a just or a righteous God. But rather, what Paul means by this, and it's a phrase that he will use elsewhere in Romans, and so in a sense, if we don't understand it completely here, we can fill it out later, but also if we go wrong here, we're going to go big wrong later on. We should realize that when he refers to the righteousness of God being revealed, he's talking about the righteousness that God gives to us, the status of righteousness that comes from God for those who believe. Okay, again, it's closely connected with faith, and that suggests already that when we look later on in the book and see righteousness and justification connected with faith, we should realize that back here, when he talked about the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, that Paul had in mind not simply an attribute of God, that God is just or righteous, but that God accounts us righteous, that he gives us the status of righteous people. Now, it was this recognition by Luther especially, which was, I suppose you could say, the dawn of the Reformation in his own mind, important for his understanding of the gospel, but also important for all of the understanding of the gospel. And it's interesting that Luther says the problem he had was that he thought of the righteousness of God in the first sense. And when he saw the righteousness of God, he was terrified. He was aware of his sins. And Luther came to understand that it wasn't that, it was something else. So here's the quote that's usually given from Luther. He realized that God's righteousness meant not the righteousness by which he, God, is righteous in himself, but the righteousness by which we are made righteous by God. Okay, so that was the key insight that Luther had, that this phrase, again, it doesn't occur simply here, but several other places, that this phrase doesn't mean simply that God is a just and righteous God and that you'd better work hard for your justification, buddy, because he's got high standards. And, you know, Luther, you're going to have to climb those stairs many more times and say all of the things you need to say and work hard. No, Luther realized that the righteousness of God is the gift of righteousness from God, the free gift of acceptance because of Christ. Now, I'm saying that that's what it means. In the immediate context, as I said, you can get some sense of that. But it will help us at this point to look a little bit ahead in Romans to see that that's how Paul uses the phrase. And I put up a few references there, 3:21-22. Some of these, the phrase righteousness of God doesn't occur, but the idea does. I think in the interest of time, let's just turn to chapter 10, verses 1 through 4. What's helpful here is that the phrase righteousness of God appears, but you can see it in contrast with the sort of error that Paul had to fight against. Romans 10, 1 through 4. Okay, so this is in that part of Romans where he's especially concerned about the state of his Jewish brothers. But he writes to his Christian brothers, "Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they may be saved. For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted to the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." Okay. I'm not going to talk about Christ being the end of the law right now. Still got 9 chapters to go before we need to figure that out. But notice the connection, everyone who believes. Okay, so it's a very similar context here. And he says that Israel was ignorant of God's righteousness. Okay, it's a very similar wording. It's God's righteousness they're ignorant of, but what do they do instead? They seek to establish their own righteousness, and thereby they have not submitted to, okay, so here's the phrase, to the righteousness of God. Okay, so you can see how the phrase the righteousness of God and being ignorant of God's righteousness, surely it doesn't mean God's righteousness in himself, his justice, okay? It has some other meaning, and the connection is clear enough, and if you like, again, maybe this afternoon, you could back up into chapter 9, and they have sought to pursue the law of righteousness, Israel has, in verse 31. So the contrast is that they tried to establish their own righteousness, but in God's righteousness, in that they have not submitted to the righteousness of God. So I hope just this one glimpse will let you see that when Paul talks about the righteousness of God, he's talking about a forensic thing, okay, that has to do with our status before God. He's not talking about our transformation into holiness or our own good works. That's exactly the contrast he's making in Romans 10. The Jews sought to establish their own righteousness. They had a zeal for God, but in that they were ignorant of God's righteousness, and they refused to submit to the righteousness of God. And how does that righteousness come? It comes to everyone who believes. So there's the contrast between seeking to establish your own righteousness and what you might say simple trust in receiving the righteousness from God. Does that make sense? So that's the basic teaching of Paul about justification that's going to be worked out in the following chapters. The reason I wanted to look in Romans 10 is just to confirm that reading that I gave in verse 17 of chapter 1 is quite consistent with what he says elsewhere. And I skipped over a bunch of chapters, but that's because I have limited amount of time. If you read elsewhere, I put up the references in Romans 3. Romans 5 talks about the gift of righteousness. You'll see that this righteousness of God isn't something that we generate in ourselves. Righteousness of God would not suggest that it would be. But it's a gift from God. And that passage in Romans 5, verse 19, uses that phrase specifically. Verse 17, specifically. Okay. So I don't think this is terribly controversial. I think among us, I think everyone sort of knows what I'm talking about and may be surprised that I would try to emphasize or clarify this point. But I don't want us, when we read the phrase, just to read into it everything we already know. Okay, we want to understand Paul in the context, and what I've done is try to make the case briefly that in context, when Paul uses the phrase the righteousness of God, he's talking about something that comes to us and is a righteous status that is a gift of God. It's not a human-generated righteousness, it is a divine righteousness, the righteousness of God. Okay, so why do I need to belabor the point? Well, it's because there is a system of teaching, you might say the whole orientation of New Testament studies now, that is opposed to that interpretation. In fact, opposed to what you might call the standard Protestant reading of the book of Romans. Okay, so I mentioned last week these new perspectives on Paul. We should use the plural. There's some variation among those who hold this view. It's really come on the radar screen of evangelical and reformed churches more in the last 10 years, but that's just because it takes things a while to trickle down to a popular level. Certainly, in the 80s, a lot of this was written, but some of this goes back to an important paper in the 60s, and even our friend Albert Schweitzer had some sympathies with this point of view. So what is their critique? Their critique is basically that Luther, in particular, was so caught up with his guilty conscience that he completely misread what Paul was saying. Okay, he poured into Paul's words the content he wanted to see in the controversy with Rome. Okay, and This analogy is helpful. It's as if you're hearing two people talk. You're not involved in the conversation. You're just sort of standing nearby, and you hear the two people talk. You only hear a snatch of the conversation, and you go away from it, and you tell someone else what they're talking about, but you're just completely wrong, because you had your own ideas in your mind, and those words mean something to you, and maybe you were thinking about that very thing, or you were concerned about it. So you basically misrepresent their conversation just because of your own perspective on things. Okay? The new perspectives on Paul say that that's the way we Protestants misread Paul. Okay. They say we completely miss the point of what he's saying. That we take his words and we pour our content into them, but he's talking about something completely different. Okay. Now, you know, maybe that wouldn't be so bad, except that what they say he is talking about in the end tends to overthrow the Protestant, and I would say biblical, doctrine of justification. So the content that they pour into the words, although at first sight may be innocent, actually ends up denying the imputation of Christ's righteousness, for example, and basically so reorienting the gospel that it's hard to recognize it. Okay. Now, is it worthwhile that for me to explain this to you and attempt to refute it? Well, I think so. I mean, I'm going to try to in the little time I have left. One of the primary proponents on a popular level of this view is N.T. Wright. N.T. Wright is a very winsome writer. I don't know how he writes so many books and so many pages in his books, but you know, one time my doctor was in the doctor's office. He mentioned that their class at church was reading a book by N.T. Wright. Now, it's not one of these books. It's something else. Wright is relatively conservative compared to the others. He defends a physical resurrection of Christ. That's good. Okay, that's good. But he especially is someone who's, because of his writings elsewhere, has drawn a lot of attention. And you will see this teaching where you may not recognize it. Part of the difficulty is that when you see this teaching, you might not recognize it because they use the same words we use. After all, they claim that we're pouring our meaning into the words, but they are actually recovering what Paul had said. Even though in the end it comes out that Paul is concerned with like social justice and ecumenical issues that happen to be quite current. But anyway, they're actually reading what Paul intended to say, and they use the language that we use. And so let me explain that a little bit. And their case is basically that Paul, in using this language about the righteousness of God, is drawing on Old Testament language. Okay, so turn with me just to Psalm 98. Okay? And this is a point that is not original with the new perspectives on Paul. I mean, Calvin makes this point. You can find others who make the same point. But in the Old Testament, when the word righteousness or the righteousness of God is used, it's often used in connection with salvation. Psalm 98, verses 1 and 2. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have gained him the victory. The Lord has made known his salvation. His righteousness he has revealed in the sight of the nations. So you see, there's the parallel. He has made known his salvation, and his righteousness he has revealed in the sight of the nations. Notice the revealed. Okay, that actually is the sense here in Romans. That the revelation comes by the powerful acting of God. Okay, but they would say, well, look, you know, the salvation that the Lord has made known in the first part of verse 2 is parallel with his righteousness. So when in the Old Testament, and this occurs, I mean, just a huge number of times, when in the Old Testament the righteousness of God is referred to, it means his powerful acts in saving his people. The Lord has made known his salvation. You can see it here, you can see it again and again. So they would say that the salvation, the righteousness of God in Romans 1:17 is not some imputation of righteousness. The righteousness of God is God's faithfulness and acting on behalf of his covenant people. Okay. Now see, already you're going to say, well, wait a second, that sounds perfectly fine to me. Right? I mean, it uses the same words. The problem is that they're not specific in what that means. So God's faithfulness and acting on behalf of his covenant people doesn't mean they don't like the idea of imputation of righteousness. Okay, so don't read that into what they say. It's much more general than that, and it can have to do with the redeeming of all of creation. And specifically, what it has to do with is the fact that God breaks down the barrier between Jew and Gentile. So that, as they like to say, Paul isn't here talking about soteriology, how we come to be saved, but about ecclesiology, about the nature of the church. So the righteousness of God has to do with the fact that God is faithful to his promises, and in the end, you don't have to become a Jew to be part of the people of God. You simply have to have faith in Christ. Sounds good. The problem is not so much what they say as what they don't say by it. And at this point, especially since I'm over time, it's good that I will have an opportunity to fill in what they do say later on. Okay, so you're going to say, well, wait a second. When he gets to Romans 3 or Romans 10, how can they take that point of view? And I'm going to say, well, I'm glad I don't have to answer that question right now because we don't have any time. But they have a way of filling it in, and the works of the law are the things that set apart the Jews from the Gentile. So you're not saved by the works of the law in the sense that you don't have to be circumcised, you don't have to eat those, you know, the right foods, because God has included the Gentiles in. He's broken those barriers. He's not talking about attempts at self-righteousness. Luther just had an oversensitive conscience. That's not what he's concerned about. The righteousness of God isn't about our own individual salvation. It's about the, you might say, the cosmic work of God to show his power. So let me just make one comment about the use of the Old Testament, and then I will shut up, okay, for now. Yes, in the Old Testament, that parallel is very strong. God's righteousness is often connected with his salvation and with his acting in covenant. But it's also used in context with judgment of the wicked. And that makes sense, right? If it's referring to the righteousness of God, then God does deliver his own people, the ones he accepts as righteous, but God judges the wicked. And if you just think about Psalm 98 at the end, you know, his equity is going to be made known. He's going to judge at the last day. So it's not as if it's all entirely positive about the love of God and the faithfulness of God, unless you think of God's destroying the wicked as part of his faithfulness. It's not all an entirely positive orientation. The righteousness of God still retains that edge of the justice of God. Okay? And it, of course, provokes an important question. Just turn with me. Sorry, one last reference in Psalm 143. We sing this, and I hope we notice it. Psalm 143, the first two verses. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Give ear to my supplications. In your faithfulness answer me, and in your righteousness. So there you go. God's faithfulness, God's righteousness are synonymous terms. So he wants God to destroy his enemies, says at the end of the psalm. But before he gets there, he thinks a little bit about what he's going to say. And that's why he says verse 2, but do not enter into judgment with your servant, for in your sight no one living is righteous. You could hardly mention the righteousness of God without realizing that I'm not righteous. And that if you actually enter into judgment with we, the way I'm going to talk about the enemy, then I'm going to be like the enemy. I'm going to be destroyed. So there's that, if you want that tension here, the psalmist realizes that when he invokes God and his righteousness, that he needs a remedy for that righteousness. And you could look at it this way. Paul is saying in Romans, in the gospel and the coming of Christ, that tension is fully resolved, because in the crucifixion of the substitute, we see that God is just and the justifier. Okay, so that's how the gospel reveals the righteousness of God. This one whose righteousness is invoked in the Old Testament for judgment is the same one who can justify us and still be righteous. So that's a very brief explanation of how the Old Testament is yes, pointing forward to the gospel, but how Paul says there is a fuller revelation in the coming of Christ. Okay. So, I think worship is important, but I just took 7 minutes away from the time in between now and worship. I will take a few comments and questions, but maybe before I do that, and I saw Dave's hand, let me say there's a lot more that can be said. You should never pass off these opponent viewpoints as if they're a bunch of idiots. Okay, these people are not a bunch of idiots. They've thought through things very carefully. I don't think they're right. There's a very brief, there are lots of books countering this. There's a very brief book by Venema, who's a very good and clear writer, called Getting the Gospel Right. It's a short book. If someone wants to borrow it, feel free to. It may actually be in the church library. This is my copy, but you should feel free to borrow it. Yes, Dave.
If we hadn't seen these words in Romans, I think you might be rightly and justly accused of concocting a work of fiction that was too good to be true.
Uh-huh.
But this is the gospel.
Right.
This is the very good news that all of us are in desperate need of. And our pastor underscored the absolute importance of understanding this declaration of righteousness as he was talking about the second coming. So this is not merely a debate of a bunch of school kids out on the playground, but forms the very hope we have because Christ will come again. And what will we do if he comes again, when he comes again, and we have to stand before him and give an answer?
Yeah, the ultimate outcome of these views is extremely important. What they lead to is crucial for the church. I agree. Yes, Derek.
Is this idea of righteousness as being righteousness that God gives to us for justification, does that help us when we read Psalm 112, the righteous will never be moved, or Psalm 37, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken? Like, does the term righteous there fit with this biblical idea of the psalmist is righteous, but because of God's righteousness?
Yes, that's true. And yet I guess I would say that there is the rest of Romans, so that the one who is accepted by God as righteous for Christ's sake is also the one who will, Psalm 112, give to the poor, will act like a righteous person. So we shouldn't so evacuate it of its that other meaning that we lead tend to antinomianism. Well, I've prayed the prayer and now I'm righteous, I'm going to heaven, but I actually don't care anything for anyone else or even worship God. So we shouldn't. That is certainly the fundamental basis, and after all, you know, Genesis is pretty early in the Bible, so Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness. So that is the underlying fact that informs righteousness throughout. But it's also a righteousness that, as in Psalm 112, is worked out in our lives. And so I'm just a little hesitant about saying that it has exclusively that meaning. It is the righteous are as the righteous do, you might say. They show their righteousness by the way they work out their faith. Yeah, but it certainly is important that we shouldn't read the Old Testament as saying, well, those guys were righteous because they had the righteousness from themselves that Paul's talking about in Romans 10. That would be an utter mistake, and that's why Paul says at the beginning of Romans 1, this isn't something new I'm presenting to you. It's completely consistent with what the Scriptures have taught. Yeah. Long answer to short question. So, guess I'm good at that. Okay, any other comments or questions? Okay, so I really would encourage you after we pray to get over to worship quickly. I think our preacher would appreciate that too, right?
Yeah.
Let's close in prayer.